My name is Mark Schwain, and session this morning is entitled Spirited Inquiry, subtitled The Courage to Know. Welcome to all of you this morning. I've been this week in three prior sessions, this is the fourth in the series, been talking about matters having to do very broadly with education. And I suppose if there's a theme that ties each of those sessions together into a kind of unity, the theme really has been captured in the title of today's presentation called Spirited Inquiry, because the theme has been a kind of argument that suggests that there's a kind of integral connection, very tight connection, between the life of the spirit and the life of the mind, and that really to learn, really to teach, really to engage in education must mean simultaneously to cultivate certain of those virtues which we call moral or spiritual, virtues like generosity and humility, charity, and certain of the cognitive skills or intellectual virtues, and that really that kind of development of the spiritual and the moral on the one hand and the intellectual on the other is a process that is of a piece. And I've tried in successive sessions to show how that's true and to lament the fact that our culture has very much come largely through its own practices of higher learning to separate very sharply what you might call cognitive skills, cognitive development, technical training on the one hand, from moral and spiritual development on the other. And that one needs to seek ways in which to think through matters so as to change that particular division in our vocabulary and in our thinking and in our educational practices. As examples of that, I've often given the reminded people that they're disposed often to speak about how so-and-so is a brilliant chemist or a brilliant historian or a wonderful engineer, and yet one wouldn't want to trust one's children with them for more than 5 minutes. People always do laugh a bit when I give that example, recognizing that they have said something or another like that. And I point out that that's a very peculiar thing to say, though we say it fairly routinely, because for most of Western history, human excellence was understood really to be much more of a piece that one thought about human beings who were worthy of regard and esteem and honor as being the sorts of folks who would be the sort that you would want to trust your children with, your friends with, and who would also be very good at whatever discipline or trade or practice that you would want to mention. Human excellence was much more of a piece. Today it's kind of divided up into separate compartments. And I think our problem as a culture, and then our problem too as a church, is to think together about how to reunite those things which our culture has separated so sharply. So that's been my basic theme. And today I want to pursue it by looking in some depth at one virtue, which is really taken in a way from the Holden Prayer when we speak about wanting the faith to go out with good courage. I want to really examine the virtue of courage and to think together about how important it is for learning, for education. So I want to begin with a kind of period of reflection. I'm going to ask us to be quiet for 3 minutes, a kind of unusual thing to do in a session. I suppose this will probably vex the tape people, who will have a whole 3 minutes of total silence on the tape and may not know how to manage this. And I want to apologize to subsequent guests who listened to the tape, to listen to the 3 minutes of silence, but invite those guests who listened to the tape to reflect, as we, I hope, will, on a certain matter before we proceed. What I'd like you to do is to take 3 minutes and think about some instance in your own lives when you have changed your mind about something that matters deeply to you, some belief that matters deeply to you, you have changed. Not some trivial thing like you always believed that Keokuk was in Illinois but found out that it was in Iowa. Not some minor thing like that, but some belief that you held and even cherished at some point and then have found yourself changing that belief. I want you to recall something like that. And once you've recalled that, I want you to take the second step and ask, on what basis or through what process did you come to change your mind? Is that clear? Or is the assignment clear before we pause? Okay, let's pause and take 2 or 3 minutes to think that one through. Okay, our 3 minutes are up. Would anybody like to volunteer? We don't necessarily have to volunteer what it was you changed your mind about. I'm more interested in hearing some account from one or another or several of you on what it was that led you to change your mind about something that mattered to you. Yes?
I started talking to other people with the same concerns, or just by knowing another person and verbalizing with them, hearing them.
So it was through conversation with others.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just ask you one more question about that. These others with whom you conversed shared a similar concern. Were they also human beings that you had reason to trust particularly, or were they strangers, friends?
Strangers.
Okay. And how long a process did it take? Was it one evening's conversation or a long process?
A couple of years.
Okay. Yes?
I found that there's usually some sort of deep emotional response that finally is so overwhelming that the intellect can no longer ignore it.
Hmm.
And it takes, usually it's a long time to resolve it, but a knowing or a feeling, you know, it gnaws at you, it bothers you, it keeps telling you there's something that's not, what is it about this? Whether it's great fear or great hatred or great joy, but a strong emotion often lets me know that there's something is not in harmony within myself.
Okay. So for you, it was very much of in the case you recalled, very much an affective process, a matter of feelings.
Mm-hmm. Getting the intellect and the feelings
together.
To be in harmony.
Okay. And was it also a long process for you when you thought of your... Yes?
The whole thing. I mean, sometimes there'll be one point that stands out, but the whole thing is a process that continues. There may be moments that are the aha, but that's part of the process of it.
Okay, good. Yes, you had your hand up.
I think my experience is really similar to hers in that it's kind of a pile of evidence builds up against your assumption until you can't ignore it. I think in my case, in two different situations, one, like, what I had always been taught just didn't, there was so much evidence against it, and I couldn't ignore that, but I was really scared to accept the new, And finally, someone spoke a word of grace that really allowed me to finally feel free to accept a new understanding. But the other is, people I had always been taught were somehow very separate from me and wrong and led bad lives. And by meeting people and by getting to know them and realize, but these aren't bad people, I think that's like the evidence that contradicts the assumption. And so finally it overwhelms it and you say, well, then it can't be right what I've thought because this person doesn't fit that.
Okay.
I kind of resonate with both of those ideas and also some of my own personal, I'll call it research, but it usually means reading a lot on that topic or people who have gone through that situation and then getting this aha gut level feeling of, yes, this is my experience.
Okay, great, yes.
Well, I think I've been so bound and brought up and bred in the system, but for me it was some new ideas were happening, some readings and things like that, but it was when people, women in particular, affirmed me and said, you can do this, meaning that I could explore more deeply than I'd ever been taught, that I much thought that women could do that before. And it always has been someone has been there to say, you'll be okay and you can do this. And then it's real empowerment way down deep, you know, that, well, watch me go.
Other testimonies to support or amplify what's been?
We're coming from the same point of reference here, but with me, it was exploring in solitude, you know, by myself, not literally separated, but you know, months of thinking this issue, this concern through alone, and there was that exploring in the solitude, kind of my own soul, that looking back on it was really worthwhile. And then into conversation with other people and into support with other people.
Okay. Anyone else like to volunteer before we begin to reflect on the testimonies we've just heard? Cardinal Newman, the great educator in the 19th century, who wrote The Idea of a University, said once, to live is to change, and to live well is to have changed often. And the whole process by which we amplify, change, amend our beliefs, especially those cherished beliefs that really get down to the level of defining who we are, is a very mysterious one, but it seems to me your testimonies have lifted up a number of the aspects of that process that are crucial to it. And just now to pick up from what you have said, certain themes have emerged. One, it tends to be a fairly long process often. Two, it tends to involve the feelings, the sentiments, as much as it does the intellect. Three, it's a matter of living with an idea, a set of ideas for some time, whether by oneself in a kind of soul-searching way or more likely in community and in conversation with others. It's like living through the change rather than thinking about it. In other words, it's not as though you're distant from it and in an abstract way persuaded. It's that in living in company with others, with whom you discuss the matter, or in living with the idea for a while and with the feelings, you gradually begin to change. Now, this whole emphasis upon a kind of communal, that is, with others, a process, that is, over a period of time, and affections, that is, the emotions and the sentiments, is something that's largely, if not ignored, then certainly not appreciated enough in much of higher learning, which often presupposes that what will get people to change their views from X to Y really involves simply a matter of the head, or primarily a matter of the head. You hear a lecture about X, you always thought Y, and now someone argues X, and now they present some evidence on a blackboard or in a lecture, and you assent to either the weight of evidence or to the power of the argument or whatnot, and change your mind. And this just simply isn't the way life works. And yet many people comport themselves, educators especially, as though that were true. Now, bringing this into the theme of today's session, the courage to know, one or another of you mentioned the word fear, mentioned the word that you had had such a settled conviction, and that even when the evidence began to accumulate, evidence of your own experience, which doesn't necessarily mean sensory evidence, what you see and feel with your hands or hear with your ears, but even something deeper than sensory experience, emotional experience, that there was still a great inertia within you against changing your views, because to change some of your views is to change yourself. To change your mind is to risk giving up forever a part of whom you were. Okay? And the most ancient of texts on education that go way back, some of them are written in dialogue form, Platonic dialogues, and what frequently happens in those conversations, those dialogues are dialogues because they see inquiry as an act of life in community with others rather than as a kind of isolated and lonely endeavor. What often happens in those conversations is the obstacles to learning turn out not to be in those dialogues so much the fact that the person is ignorant, or the person is a slow learner, or suffers from some sort of, as we say today, quote, learning disability, unquote. The question is, the people lack courage. That is, they can't overcome the kind of fears that are holding them back from embracing the truth, or at least from coming closer to the truth of matters, which is worked out in a kind of communal conversation. And it seems to me that, therefore, the subtitle today, The Courage to Know, really wants to affirm much of what you've testified, namely that what's perhaps most important in learning is not so much cognitive skill as it is a kind of moral and spiritual courage. Now, I think the virtue of courage, which was originally understood to be a virtue that showed itself most clearly in the theater of armed conflict. When one thinks of the courageous human being, one often thought of courage really showing itself most splendidly on the field of military combat, when one would give oneself up for one's friend or for one's country or for some cause. We're talking about a different kind of theater here, and this is the theater of learning, where there's often a conflict of ideas or views or human beings or opinions. And I think when the virtue of courage gets transposed from the field of warfare to the field of intellectual or moral life, something peculiar happens to it, which I said a little bit about yesterday, but will repeat just to underscore it. It becomes something like the virtue of self-sacrifice or self-denial, meaning that you're willing to give up a part of yourself for the sake of the truth. And as I also indicated yesterday, there's something peculiar about that, in that if one is disposed to think courageously, one is disposed to find that here, in this area of life, it's always a gain to lose if you're in the midst of an argument. You have this view, someone else has that view, or some group of people have that view, and you work together to discover the truth of matters. And supposing it winds up that you lose the argument. Paradoxically enough, by losing the argument, you gain. And only by losing do you gain. What do you gain? You gain the truth. Or at least you gain a further step toward the truth. Whereas if you stick with your opinion, out of fear now, what have you gained? Probably nothing, and you may have lost your soul in the process. Now this gets complicated, of course, because it sounds as though, and here I'm going to press beyond the territory I traversed a bit last time, it gets confusing because it sounds as though one's recommending always changing one's opinion. And clearly, one ought not change all of one's opinions. One ought only to change those opinions that are unwarranted, ill-advised, or harmful to others. In other words, the problem is now to sort out which opinions one ought to change and to have the courage to change those that one ought to. And how does one do that? I wish I had an easy formula here, because we could make a tape of that and change the world if we knew, had that kind of wisdom to know how to sort through one's opinions. But I think here of the prayer of St. Francis, which some of you know, that goes like this, God give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now, I think I've thought for years, as probably most of you have who've heard that prayer, that the dominant reading one should give to that prayer is that it refers to things outside of ourselves. That is, accept the things I cannot change, meaning certain institutional arrangements, other people, social systems, the natural world, whatever. Courage to change the things I can, those things again seen as being outside of our own souls, and wisdom to know the difference. And I think that is probably the major intention of the prayer, to refer to the things outside of ourselves that we need to accept, some of them need to change, others, etc. But for the purposes of this morning, I'm inviting people to wonder together whether or not the prayer can also refer to our souls, those things about our souls that we can't change, those things that we can, and then having the wisdom to know the difference. You follow me? In other words, now the courage to change the things I can refers now to our own opinions, and finding the courage to change those opinions which we can change, okay? And so what I'm going to now explore a bit is exactly where it is one finds and how it is one finds the kind of wisdom and the kind of courage to change in ways that bring us collectively closer to some kind of truth. I thought I would read a little passage from James here, which I think casts light on this. We talk about the heart of the gospel as being John 3:16. Most of us know that passage if we've been reared in the Christian tradition for memory. For me, James 3:16, as an educator, has often been something like the gospel of education. And I'll read it to you, providing some kind of context. I'm going to begin with James 3:13. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good life, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. this wisdom is not such as comes down from above. That is, this wisdom that selfish ambition and jealousy is involved with. But is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. Now, James 3:16. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, without uncertainty or insincerity. And the harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now, these are wonderful themes. If I had to have a kind of epigram to the whole of the week that I've spent together with the village, it would be that. Because what this really powerfully lifts up is the interpersonal and communal character of wisdom. I would put it in my own words, I suppose, by saying that what educators ought to try to do is to educate in and for thoughtfulness. Okay? I'm going to put that word on the board, thoughtfulness. Because it's the one trace in our own language. One trace in our own language of the notion that I tried to outline at the very beginning of this session throughout the week. Because we use the word thoughtful to mean two very different things. On the one hand, when we say so-and-so is thoughtful, we might mean filled with ideas, incisive. Very thoughtful thing you just said. Okay? Incisive, bright. On the other hand, we use the term thoughtful, as in he or she's a very thoughtful person, to mean something like considerate, compassionate. And what this passage in James is doing in the context of talking about wisdom is to say that the wisdom from above really means a kind of thoughtfulness in both of those senses at the same time. That is, it surely means incisive, having insight into important matters of human concern. So in other words, what James is lifting up here is not only, and now I'm translating it into my own word here, thoughtful, because it's one of our common usage words, is that not only does he mean thoughtful in both senses, but he really is suggesting here that you can't be truly thoughtful in the one sense without being truly thoughtful in the other. And that unless you're compassionate and considerate, you're not going to be filled with the kind of insight and understanding that the other side of thoughtful means. And unless you have the kind of insight and understanding that the sense of thoughtful means, you're not going to be fully compassionate and considerate. These things are kind of deeply interlaced. Thus, when I talk about spirited inquiry, I mean to pick up what's really spiritual as opposed to unspiritual, and put it together with inquiry, the kind of activity that's central to education, and suggest that it's this kind of wisdom that ought to kind of govern our inquiries and empower us to be courageous, to cast out the kind of fear that often stands between us and a growth into the truth. And again, my point is that so much of learning today has lost sight of the powerful truth that we find here in James. Now I want to move from your testimonies to my synthesis of those and the word of James to say some sort of sobering things to you all, to share some sobering thoughts, and to drive home how vitally important I think these matters are for us as a community here at Holden and for us as a country. A new book, The Work of Nations, which is going to get a lot of press, has just come out within the last year. It is subtitled Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism, and it's written by a man named Robert Reich.
How do you spell
that? R-E-I-C-H. Robert Reich. It's a complicated argument, which I won't attempt to rehearse entirely for you. But what Reich is basically arguing is that all of our thoughts about the nation state and national economies and our identity as a people as somehow being bound up with the well-being of our national economy is completely outmoded now. And that basically we are, in effect, a part of a global web. And that basically those of us who still think of our common well-being as somehow bound up with our own gross national product or the profitability of our corporations are simply now like dinosaurs in that kind of thinking. That what really is the case is that we're already bound up economically into a kind of global matrix, and that we have to come to see that whether or not Mitsubishi is putting up the plants in Illinois for which people are working, or whether or not it's Chrysler Corporation is irrelevant. The fact is that the prosperity of the people working there are going to be just as great regardless of whether it's Mitsubishi or Chrysler, etc. That's one part of the argument. But the heart of the argument, which I want to lift up now because it pertains to education, is that the whole structure of work in the world is altering such that there are really now only three major occupational groupings, and the percentage of folks in each of these groupings is shifting dramatically. Group one, and this, by the way, according to Reich, counts for 80% of the work that human beings do, is routine production services. Routine production services. What he means by that is basically what had for many years been the heart and soul of industrial capitalism. Those people who worked on assembly lines and performed routine tasks day after day. And now he includes under routine production services all those people who, for example, work in something like data processing, meaning that they simply take data like hospital bills and type them into computers and code cards or whatever is done, et cetera. Anything that's routine, that's removed from the final product, that's somewhat impersonal, and that's performed over and over again is a routine production service. Two is called in-person services. This is what we would normally call the whole range of service activities in which the human beings performing those services do have direct relationship with the people they're immediately serving. For instance, waitressing, auto mechanics, okay, where you basically are performing a service for a person or a group of persons and you have some kind of direct relationship with those persons. Daycare centers, etc. A whole burgeoning set of activities that fall under here. But three, and this is the one that Reich talks about most, is called symbolic analytical services. And this is the area that's growing. And I'm going to read you a brief description of the people that are included under this heading. These basically are people who manipulate and who broker abstract systems of information.
You had 80% for number one?
No. These three together count for 80% of jobs. Okay. There's another 20% of agricultural labor, for instance, excavating industries that extract metals from the earth, etc., that are not in any of these three categories. That's the other 20%. But these three together are 80%. But now here are the symbolic analysts. These include all of the problem-solving, problem-identifying, and strategic brokering activities. Like routine production services, symbolic analytic services can be traded worldwide and thus must compete with foreign providers, even in the American market. But they do not enter world commerce as standardized things. Traded instead are the manipulation of symbols, data, words, oral and visual representations. Included here are research scientists, design engineers, software engineers, civil engineers, biotechnology engineers, sound engineers, public relations executives, investment bankers, lawyers, real estate developers, and even a few creative accountants. Also included, management consultants, financial consultants, tax consultants, energy consultants, agricultural consultants, management information specialists, organization development specialists, strategic planners, corporate headhunters, systems analysts, also advertising executives, marketing strategists, art directors, architects, cinematographers, film editors, production designers, publishers, writers, editors, journalists, musicians, television and film producers, even university professors. Okay, now, his point as he goes on, and this is where things get very sobering, is that this country is extremely good at educating folks in that category, but that the global web is such that those folks, as they go forth, tend to relate not so much to their fellow citizens, for whom they seem to care less and less in terms of how they expend their income. Charitable contributions from folks in this category have plummeted over the last 10 years, for example. But that basically their sense of identification, loyalty, and concern goes to that counterpart group in Japan, Canada, Western Europe, increasingly Eastern Europe, Asia, etc. So the symbol analysts, through modems and computer wiring networks and other things, are highly mobile, not particularly loyal to any given corporation or region or even nation, and that these people are, and here's the frightening part, gradually seceding from their fellow citizens in all the nations of the world. Their primary loyalties, sense of obligation, sense of community is to the other symbol analysts who are their counterparts in other countries. Okay? So there's plenty of globalization going on at this level, but the problem is that in any way that it can be measured, the symbol analysts are seceding from the other 80% of those folks in other jobs in their own countries. Okay? This is a trend that's going to continue. So Reich's statement here, we're very good at, in fact without peer, in training symbol analysts. He trained symbol analysts at Harvard Business College, and he points out that now 40% of them are foreign nationals. 40% of his students are from Japan, Africa, Asia, everywhere. And so we export this expertise all the time. But the problem is, where, he says, do we instill in the symbol analyst some sense of care for and responsibility for the other 80% of the people on the globe? That's the problem. And he basically has no solution for it. All he has is a kind of an alarming set of projections that show how the rich are going to get even richer and the poor even poorer. He has startling statistics on, for example, management's income is now 10 times over what it was in terms of the difference between its income and the income of labor as it was 15 years ago. And the symbol analysts are simply that whole range of folks I mentioned and some others besides. It's not just that they're getting wealthier by comparison to the 80% who are getting poorer. It's that their whole sense of obligation to and care for other people is diminishing. So as technical expertise in symbol manipulation rises, what seems to fall is some sense of public spiritedness, some sense of common good, some sense of compassion and care for others. Okay? Now you see how this is going to translate back into this crucial issue of education. Unless we find some way in the manner in which we teach, in the manner in which we learn, in the manner in which we relate to one another in this society, we are going to simply produce specialists without spirit and sensualists without heart, and we're simply going to have, yes, plenty of globalization, but for this 20%. And the others will suffer perhaps increased misery. This is his fear. He says at the end of the book that we've got to find some way to correct this, because he sees no way of changing this basic trend in the structure of occupations and in the shape of the world, but he doesn't have very many ideas of how we can go about doing that. He does indicate that what's at the heart of the education of symbol analysts is the capacity to inquire. He says at the beginning of one of the chapters that there's no better way to learn inquiry than to inquire. No shortcut to cultivating the imagination and so forth, other than to work together with others to do that. But what he doesn't seem to recognize is that unless the inquiry is spirited, and by spirited I mean now to refer back to the passage I read you from James, there will be this kind of unspiritual wisdom which does consist and breed a kind of selfish ambition, which is James's word for it, and jealousy, which then leads to discord, kind of widening between rich and poor and so forth, and strife. So my point is that we're not talking about something that is simply a minor issue in how we educate one another and our young. We're talking about something utterly critical to the future of the world. And it seems to me that unless we are prepared to arrange our pedagogy and our institutions in such a way so that we instill in people the courage, the compassion, the charity, the generosity to use what it is that one learns at the college and university level for the good of others, our situation as a planet is going to become increasingly desperate. And I must say that Reich, who is not somebody whose work I know well apart from this book and who's in a very different discipline from mine, nonetheless has written, in my judgment, a very compelling account of what we can expect unless we begin to amend our ways, unless we find a way to make people not only technically creative, but also increasingly committed to the well-being of other human beings. Now, my point is this, and here's my sort of bottom line before opening things back up. I think when a group like this one or others hears this kind of sober prediction and basically agrees that some kind of solution is called for, we often fall into the trap of thinking, well, let's let the universities and the technical institutes and the corporations worry about training people in technical skills, and then let's let the family and the church and other institutions worry about forming people in the spiritual virtues, as though these things can go on in two separate places. And I think that is a fatal error. The error is that somehow, in the course of training people to be symbol analysts, we're not also forming them spiritually, because I think we are. And so what I think we need to see is that unless our whole educational system is reinfused in the manner in which people learn together, in the manner in which teachers and students relate to one another, with examples of the very virtues we want to instill in our students, it seems to me that we're lost. In other words, we need the kind of spiritual wisdom that James talks about here as our fundamental aim. And unless those virtues are grounded in a spiritual tradition, which can give them repeated sustenance and strength, I think that we may be in real difficulty. And in fact, already are in some real difficulty here. Okay, I'm going to stop now, having sobered us a bit, and invite some questions and comments from you in the time we have left. Yes.
Well, I have been thinking a great deal about this same topic, and it seems to me that it is very pervasive in throughout our whole society. It is not just in education. And to me, a big part of it I trace back to our dominating and winning and losing and lack of respect for people that seems to be inherent in all of the systems, including the church.
Mm-hmm.
And families, just the way our whole society seems to function. And it's very hard to all of a sudden tell people, well, you must think of other people. You know, we need to lead by example. We need to rethink our own personal interactions so that instead of wanting to win and lose in an argument in changing our ideas, we can respect the idea that we, you know, each have a different viewpoint, a different vision, and no one sitting in a circle sees the center, you know, for example, the cross there, in exactly the same way. If we all sat with a piece of paper and sketched it, we would each have our truth of that cross as we sit
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, rather than going back to this first idea that you were talking about winning and losing an argument is to win it, because that's how you gain, I see it more as a sharing
mm-hmm.
with another person, so that when that person has, when I have been allowed to experience a little bit of that person's vision,
mm-hmm.
you know, I won.
Mm-hmm.
we work together, we have linked, you know, that's how we get that webbing that can go globally, I think. But it's a very personal thing to do, to take that action.
Yes, it is.
To start living that way.
Yes, it is. And it's hard, I think, in part because most of us, unless we've been very lucky, have not been educated in ways that have encouraged us to live through that kind of truth that you have given to us. And so you're right. Then it becomes very hard at the end of that to say, and oh, by the way, you have to care for others. You know, what does that mean? It falls on deaf ears. People have been formed in such a way that they're just not disposed to do that. And part of the reason they're not disposed to do that is that we send people messages all the time that in order for them to get an A, someone else has to get a C, and in order for, we have a lot of these zero-sum games that we play, and so all of our rhetoric about caring for others within the educational system is going to seem empty if we haven't, in the way we've gotten people to learn together, getting them to see the truth of what you just, live the truth of what you just said, about how all these different perspectives are needed to get the full truth here of the cross, as you, in your example, which I think is an excellent example. Yes?
I guess where I always end up, you go back to Pilate, what is truth? I work in English as a second language with a lot of people from a lot of different countries with a lot of different ideas and philosophies of life. I do not teach them, quote, Christianity, because that's not, well, to get the law. But I try to live it. I get a lot of questions about it. And at some point, and I never, it's not always the same point. At some point, there's a point beyond which I can't go with them because of my orientation in Christ. And when you start looking at a world vision, I never know for sure where that point's going to be. And that's my struggle always. I think there is a point where I have to stop. Does that make any sense? This is something I struggle with, and seeing a lot of different ideas. And it's not always the same. You know, it's true, we change. And where I would have stopped 5 years ago is not where I would be today or where I'll be probably next time. But I still have a feeling that there is this grounding and that closes some things off.
Okay, could you give some, can you be more concrete about what you mean by stopping at a certain point and so on?
I guess acceptance, maybe. I can love a person, but I can't accept all their ideas and say, you are, your idea is as good as my idea in all areas.
No, no.
But I'm feeling that is being told in many cases, in many things I read, that all ideas are acceptable equally, and I see a lot of that in writing. Let's just put it that way for now.
No, I think you're right to resist. I mean, I think your instincts there are very sound. One's not looking for a situation in which one moves from a set of hard and fast opinions to a set of accepting them all equally. One's really after, it seems to me, the truth of matters. And one must be sufficiently open to listen and put the best construction on what other people have to say before one re-examines one's own. But the whole notion is that those people and you and everybody else ought to be involved in a common enterprise, common endeavor, to approximate more closely the truth of matters, which is probably not going to coincide with anybody's opinion in the room at a given time. Probably all going to do some growing there. But I mean, your instinct, it seems to me, is quite sound. You don't want to just suddenly admit willy-nilly anyone's opinion as being as truthful as anyone else's, because that's just not the way things are. I have a lot of false opinions even now. If I knew which ones they were, I would abandon them. The problem is I don't. Other people have to point them out to me, you know. Yes?
I also work with English as a second language students. And it certainly does one open one up to seeing things in a new way. And I have, I think, experienced a little bit of the same thing, and I don't have any great solution for it. But one of the things that I found that had to change for me was the sense of rightness. That my opinion had to be right, and therefore theirs had to be wrong. And, for example, in the religions, in that viewpoint, I can accept mine as mine, and I can accept their views and not dislike or not be able to work with them as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our system has not allowed that. And it feels that to live with ambiguity is not something we do easily.
Mm.
You know, and I think that's one where I don't know what the final solution is on that, but mm-hmm. I can't honor the other person, their person.
Anybody else resonate to this kind of difficulty that's come up now a couple of times? The view that somehow as a corollary to your opinions being right, the others have to be wrong, and then how does one deal with others? Through, quote, just acceptance, or through attempting to change their opinions, or where do you draw the line or stop, or however you put it? Yes, you had your hand up.
I don't know, I'd be surprised that just as a teacher in the global kind of thing that you were talking about, and in our society, it seems like equipping myself, and then I can equip others to be real comfortable with them.
Equipping yourself to what?
With the
ability
of living in question.
Oh, okay.
And that's the greatest gift, is to not have to be right all the time, especially
me. Rilke. Rilke has said that about living the questions.
Yes. I like that living the questions formulation.
Yes. And I think at some point you agree to disagree and you say it's right for me. I cannot say that any way to God is the right way for me. To me, Christ has to be part of this. And yet I have been told, and I've had discussions,
that, you know, the Great Spirit is the same for all of the world, and that may be true. The Lord may tell me that when I reach the end of my life. But for me, I have to say, you know, I respect your idea, but I still witness to Christ as the center of my faith. And at that point, I guess we've agreed to disagree, and there's nothing more to say except we can live our life then as we feel it is for us.
Yes, John.
There must be a bright spot in this scene somewhere here. And just looking at it, I would say that item number 3 is the power structure in each country. And if we could get those people together, all races and creeds and so forth, maybe it's just a step towards an ultimate global union of some sort. So that, but economically, that formula really has some problems globally.
Yes, I agree with you. If we can get them together and they're formed in ways that one can persuade them to meet as a community and think of the overall well-being of the globe, yes.
Now, if you put power and prejudice together, you're going to get a lot of injustice in there. But a lot of the injustices are taken care of by the global aspect of the concept. So maybe there is some good in that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, his book is not nearly as sobering in its tone as my tone in describing the book. He sees some bright spots in the very ways you're pointing them out in the book.
But